Constructive criticism and limited time only are brought to you by Oasis Games. Oasis Games is your number one supplier for MTG singles, sealed merchandise, and supplies. Visit them online at www.oasisgamesslc.crystalcommerce.com. First time buyers, use the code CCMTG for 15% off their initial purchase, or you can use the code WouldThatBeGood for 5% off. Oasis Games, your game connection. Limited time only and constructive criticism are proudly sponsored by themanabase.com. The Mana Base loves supporting their content creators and features such personalities as Nikachu, the Merfolk Master. The Mana Base was also the first one to congratulate Danny Cathro on his GP Top 8. Visit themanabase.com today.
Spencer, and I am joined by my co-host, Matthew Kling.
Hey, how's it going?
And Michael Hinderock.
What's up?
So, it's really funny. I was really excited to talk to you guys today. To the listeners, it feels like I haven't been on the show in weeks and weeks, but I was on a show and a half last week.
Just not the show.
Because we recorded the beginning twice. Yeah. So, you know, that was
100% my fault.
And I apologize. You don't need to be sorry. I really appreciate you guys stepping up and like doing it without me when I was sick, though. So I just want to give a big thank you to you guys really quick. But that isn't what this show is about. The show is about improving at Magic. Welcome, Michael and Matt, to this week's episode. I'm really excited to talk to you guys about Standard in week one. Don't worry, you can check out the rest of the network at constructivecriticism.com, limited time only, common knowledge, as well as tons of other content, including a daily stream that you guys were part of. You guys were watching yesterday, every day at 11 p.m. Eastern at twitch.tv/ccmtg. You can watch the Trophy Mages, as we like to call ourselves now. You know, it's really fun. We're really excited about it. So,
do you have to get a trophy before you can call yourselves that? Or right now are you the trophy list?
No, mages? Trophy Mage looks for trophies. He doesn't just have one already. He has to search his deck for one, you know?
Okay.
I got this all figured out. You come at me swinging, Michael, but I got answers. You know who else has answers is our sponsors, but we don't do that anymore. Thank you so much to Kyle, one of our listeners, for doing the bumpers at the beginning of the show. However, due to the demanding requests of my co-hosts, we will still have sponsor segues throughout the show, and I'm just going to surprise them with them. So,
excellent.
So we won't actually go through sponsors. You'll just pretend like you were going to go through sponsors.
No. You'll see. Stay tuned, Michael. Right. You gotta.
Well, I mean, I'm priced into staying tuned. Yes, that will happen.
I have to listen to the whole episode.
Yeah, exactly. Matt, I have some news for you. You should listen to the whole episode as we're doing it.
You don't have to listen to me. It's fine.
But you can join us every week in improving, along with the network, with #AlwaysImproving. #AlwaysImproving is the point of this podcast. We believe if you're not getting better, you're getting worse. As Michael said on the show last week, I was really proud of him for keeping that going. And we want to be doing what we can all the time to be improving ourselves. So with that being said, do you guys care if I go first this week?
You're listed first in the show notes. I think you're obligated to go first.
That's true, but I usually just mix it up every week. Guys, I think I played like 100 games/matches of Magic on Arena in the last like 5 days. Like, it's probably the most matches of Magic I've ever played in that short of time.
That sounds like a lot. Yeah.
Sweet.
Dude, you can get in so many matches. But I did
makes me like
seven
Arena more if it's getting you to play that much Magic.
Yeah, I did 7 drafts and 3 leagues and then a bunch of free play, it's been amazing. I've like played so much Magic, all from basically my bed, falling asleep. It's been amazing. I'm loving this standard. I'm really loving this draft format, and it's really nice to like be able to get in a ton of games of Magic before a Grand Prix. It's something that I always want to be doing, and I don't get a chance to do it enough. And Arena specifically has let me play just so much Magic. So that's kind of what I did to improve this week, was just mass amounts of games. And it was interesting. I saw a lot of things about the gameplay and things like that. And you kind of have to sometimes slow yourself down on Arena, because if you don't, you can, like, sometimes the auto tapper will mess you up. But it's actually forced me to think about things a little bit better. It's really cool. Like, really cool. I'm kind of rambling in this segment for the first time in a long time. But there's so much information from the amount of Magic that I played that I don't really know what to focus on, other than one thing that I did notice that I need to learn from is sometimes, and this is something that Matt has complained about on MTGO and that I've complained about on MTGO, where sometimes your opponents are just really bad. And when I was thinking about, like, how do I solve this problem, because I was playing a sealed league on Modo, and like my opponents were just bad. And I was like, I don't feel like I'm learning from this. And what I realized is that I have an opportunity to improve still by thinking about the things that they could have done differently to beat me specifically. And I had never really thought about that before as like an opportunity to learn. What do you guys think about that?
I think if you're recognizing mistakes your opponents are making, you're obviously like, it's more to me when bad play becomes a detriment, it's when your opponent is sort of taking you out of thinking about the game because their plays are so bad. So as long as you're able to remain focused on the game and still thinking about the optimal lines from your side and what you expect them to do, mm-hmm. I think you're still probably learning.
Sure. So my thought is that when bad play becomes a detriment is when you start relying on it. I've certainly played a lot at the FNM level where I will specifically set up punts for my opponent that I know that they will walk into, and if you try to make those plays at a competitive level, you're just going to get burned most of the time.
Yeah. And that's actually the exact thing that I was trying not to do. It's like, I'm just going to play this correctly. I know that he would totally fall for this, or she would totally fall for this, but like that's actually not going to help me at this GP this weekend, so I need to play correctly. And in doing that, right. I also, like, I was playing a bunch of mono red, and I found opportunities to, I'm honestly really bad at playing mono red for compared to some of the people that I watch play mono red that play it really well. And I found a lot of opportunities to learn about combat in this standard format by playing mono red this week. And, I made plays that, like, the correct play, one of the games that I lost, I made the correct play. My opponent made the wrong play and won, and I, like, wasn't even mad. I was like, oh, okay. Like, I think that, like, 70% of the time I win the game because I made this play, and, you know, kind of, do you know what I'm saying? I feel like I'm rambling.
No, I mean, I understand. It's something that comes up a lot. I've actually heard opposite opinions on this, but I do think that it is better to be upset when you play badly and not worry about the variance. So I've heard people say that they get more upset when they lose to variance rather than poor play, but I think that for me at least, if I get variance out of a game, like, it has to be pretty ridiculous variance, and honestly I only get tilted about really high variance when it's a match that is for nothing. Like, if I'm playing some random league on Modo and there's some, like, you know, 1%er that happens to me, I'll get pretty tilted about it for about, you know, 20 minutes or whatever. But
sure.
Most of the time I'm pretty laid back about getting variance out of a game and more interested in what the correct plays were and if I played as well as I could have.
Well, Matt, what did you do to improve at Magic this week?
Well, I played a modern 1K this weekend in paper, and I've been losing the first round of Magic a lot recently, and I have a new favorite saying, which is, if I wasn't planning to win 8 in a row, then why did I bother showing up? And, you know, this weekend I actually managed to do that, so.
Wait, where what were you playing in?
I was playing in the Modern 1K, just in paper.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I didn't actually win 8 in a row. I only won 6 in a row, and then we chopped the top 4, but.
Okay. What do you think your biggest takeaway from those, like, you had mentioned on the podcast that didn't get posted that one of the things that you really care about in Magic is like playing for something, and you specifically had mentioned how those 1Ks are really cool for you. What about them really helps you improve at Magic?
Well, I don't know. To be honest, I don't think there's anything specifically about the 1Ks that help me improve at Magic any more than
just
anything
just
else.
Just your mindset?
Right. If I'm being honest, the reason that I'm doing well in the paper 1Ks is because I need the money, so, you know.
Okay.
It's supplementary income.
But that's
income.
The thing, right? Is the something being on the line for you, you stated as something that's helped you keep your focus in Magic events. So how
yeah,
do you...
Certainly.
How can the listeners learn from that and translate that?
I would say that if you can, always play as though you're playing for something. If it's something that matters to you, you'll usually play better. If you just don't care, it's easy to get discouraged or you know, just stop caring, especially if you take a early loss.
Sure. Cool. Awesome. Michael, how about you? How did you improve at Magic or Life this week?
Most of the Magic that I've played in the last week has just been trying to sort of get on track as far as this Grand Prix is concerned, and a lot of that is just sort of trying to learn from other people. I think sometimes it's easy to like fly through a lot of drafts and sort of win with the good decks and lose with the bad decks, and at the end not really have figured out a lot. And I think by taking sort of I'm more interested in like what cards are good and bad, what cards are overperforming and underperforming relative to maybe how I was evaluating them than I am in the actual results of how I'm drafting.
Okay.
The thought being just that, like, I'm not in the kind of spot right now with this format where it makes a lot of sense to get excited about 3-0-ing or get discouraged about losing the first round. It's more just kind of part of a process and just trying to understand where in the approach things are going well or poorly.
Awesome. Cool. Well, let's move on to our next segment. Before we do that, we want to just mention, you know, you can support the podcast directly going to patreon.com/ccmtg, becoming a patron of the show, starting at $1 more per month. Anything that you do is really appreciated. And if you are a patron, you got to ask a patron question. And Michael, why don't you go ahead and read this week's patron question for us?
This week's patron question says, what is your opinion on the value of removal in a match of Magic? Is it useful because it allows you to clear out blockers so your creatures can do more damage? Is it helpful to remove the need to block so you can attack with your creatures? Is it to keep from dying when the opponent has unchecked threats? Is it valuable because of efficiency? You often spend less mana to remove a creature that costs more mana. What is the importance of exiling removal, and is it worth the higher casting cost or other color restraints? How do you balance the low casting cost and high efficiency of conditional removal with the flexibility of unconditional removal? Is it sometimes better to have more threats when your removal is dead in your hand? What is the strategy of aggressive decks that choose to be very light on removal?
Awesome. So that is a huge question. But I actually really like it because I want to start just with the starting question, Matt, if that's okay with you. Matt, yeah. What is your opinion on the value of removal in a given match of Magic?
Well, I would say that it's all of the above for the next 5 or 6 questions that he has. It's something that allows you to clear out blockers for your creatures to get more damage through. It's something that allows you to kill creatures so you don't have to block. It's something that keeps you from dying. It creates mana efficiencies. The value of removal really varies from deck to deck, so it's hard to say in a vacuum what the value of removal is. But
do you
yeah, assuming that it meets some of these criteria.
Yeah, I think that you hit the nail on the head there. And I think it matters differently from match to match and from deck to deck and from matchup to matchup. Because what ends up happening, right, like we could talk about Fatal Push. Like, Fatal Push has negative value in a control mirror, but it has immense value in other matchups. So it's contextual in so many different ways. And it's funny, thinking about like ways to get value out of your removal, a really good example of this, right, is like using your Fatal Push on your own Scrap Heap Scrounger against control decks when they're trying to like exile it is a really good example of like the value of removal changes from matchup to matchup, and it's your job to figure out what it's about and how to utilize those cards.
Yep, definitely.
Yeah, I think that's a Michael? Good point. And one of the things that I would say about both like deck building and actually figuring out how to cast your removal spells most effectively is that it's like one of the main forms of agency that you have in a lot of games of Magic. Just like deciding how to use your removal spells, when to use your removal spells, why you're using them the way you are is like just one of the main ways you can impact a game. And I think that, like, to Spencer's point, just being mindful of what you're really trying to do in a match. So, you know, maybe Fatal Pushing your own Scrap Heap Scrounger seems like a poor use of a card, but if it's the best use you're going to get out of the Fatal Push, you know, maybe it's what allows you to win.
Yeah. The other thing that I think that we should really touch on this question is, like, balancing the color requirements and mana requirements of removal spells in your deck. Matt, when you are, like, we'll take Grixis Energy as an example, as Grixis is kind of making a comeback in Standard right now, how do you decide between Abrade, Harnessed Lightning, Magma Spray, and Fatal Push, as well as Vraska's Contempt and, you know, even Chandra?
Well, so right now I think they're leaning more towards Fatal Push because, I mean, if we're looking for specific examples, the reason is because it doesn't kill, Magma Spray doesn't kill very much right now. The consideration that I made when I was playing Grixis regularly was that I played Magma Spray over Fatal Push because it was much easier to cast, since you had Spire Bluff Canals that came into play untapped on one. I assume that Fatal Push is not great on their mana, so that's definitely a nod to the fact that Magma Spray just isn't killing enough right now.
Yeah, I think when I was looking at lists, most of them were actually on Magma Spray from this weekend.
Oh, interesting. So I haven't looked at a huge number of lists, but I did look at the list that won the PTQ online, and I'm pretty sure he was playing 4 Fatal Pushes and 0 Magma Sprays.
Yeah, I know Jonathan Jobe took second at the Open with Magma Spray, and then a lot of the ones throughout the team event were playing Magma Spray. But what I think is important here is what
the point that remains valid, which is that you're trading mana.
Yes.
You're trading the ability to cast the spell on turn one for a slightly more powerful spell that maybe is oftentimes more of a 2-drop because you can't actually play Fatal Push and another 1-drop on turn two. So,
well, I think that's even true in that deck of Magma Spray too, because you like you are forced to place like a cycle land check land mana base, and because of that, it means that let's just take Magma Spray and Fatal Push out of it. One of those questions is like, how do you take in mana considerations? And if I'm playing a ton of tap lands, it might mean that I actually play less 2-drop removal spells than I wanted to, so that I don't fall behind on tempo, and I want to play the most efficient and best 1-drop removal spell that works with my mana so that I can continue to be in the game.
Right, yeah, definitely. It might be that you consider cast down a more efficient removal spell, but you find that you need to have the ability to slot in one mana plays because of the fact that you're playing a bunch of tap lands.
Right. And
yeah. Michael, any thoughts on this?
Even beyond just being able to cast things on one, I think with both these spells, one of the really important elements is that they work really nicely as like the second spell in a turn. They allow you to cast like a 3-mana spell and a 4-mana spell, or a 2-mana spell and a 1-mana spell, or a 4-mana spell on what, right? Like, they're both efficient even outside of just being potential 1-drops. So I think that you're kind of trying to find a balance between mana considerations and killing the things you needed to kill. So if you're expecting more mono green following this weekend, you know, maybe you decide that killing Heart of Kirin and Greenbelt Rampager is more important than being able to kill Bomat Courier or, you know, or like hitting mono red when they're on the play. So I think that like a lot of these are just sort of trade-offs, and it's just deciding about what you're willing to give up in different matchups, because there's going to be times where one is better and times where one is worse. And again, I think it's really just about making a choice with a reason rather than choosing one at random.
Yeah, and speaking of choices with a reason, if you just look at the last part of his question, what the strategy of aggro decks that choose to be very light on removal are, I think that is the consideration. They're like, I need to play a certain number of creatures at certain mana costs in order to effectively put my opponents on their heels, but I also need to be able to play the right type of removal. So a good example of this could be how Affinity has moved completely back to Galvanic Blast in the last couple of years, and back away from Dispatch?
Yeah, no one's really playing much Dispatch, but I think even more, like, you see this example a lot in kind of go wide aggro decks, where a lot of the time, like, they're getting some payoff for sort of density of creatures versus specific creatures surviving.
Right.
And basically, playing a higher density of creatures is better if your opponent is playing removal spells, but your creatures also sort of act as removal spells against opposing creatures.
And your creatures don't matter at that point, right? It's just actually like, this Burning Tramissary is the same thing as this other card. I actually don't care.
Right. So a lot of the time in the decks that are more based on density, you have to be a little bit more careful because you don't have singular powerful threats that can take over a game in the same way that, like, say, a Hazoret can or something like that. So you have to be a little bit more cautious about playing a bunch of removal spells that might sit dead in your hand.
Right. Yeah, right. I mean, a lot of the decks that come to mind that are like aggro decks in recent memory that didn't have a lot of removal relied on things like Anthems. And in those cases, if you draw removal spells instead of actual creatures to play into them, then the Anthems become much worse.
Right.
Right, whereas if you continue to draw
creatures... I was going to say, that's actually why I used Affinity as an example, and what I wanted to get into is, like, how many things can I afford to play that aren't specifically artifacts in my Ravager, Steel Overseer, Master of Aetherium deck, right? It's not that many.
Well, and Mox Opal, even the biggest one, right?
Right.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, yeah. that's a good point.
Right, but ultimately we're looking at sort of a density deck on some level, right? Like, right. Galvanic Blast is a really nice magic card, but you definitely don't want three of them in your opener.
Nope. Cool. I think we covered that question pretty well. Let us know if there's anything else we can do to answer that. We really appreciate the patrons of the show, and this segment's really fun for us when we get to dive deep on a subject like that. So thank you so much for the question. Let's move on. We're going to skip power rankings this week, specifically because it's going to be a little bit of a shorter episode, but we want to talk about Standard week one reactions. And we've done this episode a lot of times throughout the years, but trying to figure out like what makes the week one reactions the best. And this week, when we were thinking about the events, right, that people might care about, we have the Standard Classic, the Team Open, and the Online PTQ. And immediately, I think all of us gravitated towards the PTQ. And the problem is that the PTQ doesn't tell the whole story, and the Classic and the Team Open don't tell their own story very well. And so, for that reason, we're not going to do a power rankings. Instead, we're just going to cover kind of our thoughts on our Week 1 Standard reactions. So, with that being said, Matt, what is the one thing that you were looking for from Decklist this weekend going into it?
Well, I mean, I was looking to see if there were any ways that people were abusing Nicol Bolas that I hadn't thought of. I think that's one of the frontrunners of the new set, if not the most powerful card in the new set. So I was really curious to see what direction people took that one specifically.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the Stompy decks, I was a little bit surprised to see Thorn Lieutenant over whatever else you could play, but... wasn't something I was necessarily looking for, but it was something that was curious to me, and I noticed right away.
Michael, you go into a week one format that's not really like a brand new format, right? We're just introducing one set to a format that had a banning not that long ago. of easily the most powerful cards. What are you looking for going into a week one like this? Like, is a Tomb with Aether and all the ban cards on the ban list? Does that make you think that more cards can have an impact from a core set like this?
I think with the set being so big, or with the format rather being so big, I think that you're just realistically not going to see huge impact, especially from a core set, in terms of like fundamentally changing the kind of decks people are interested in playing. But I think you see a lot of improvements, and I guess that probably my biggest point of interest this first week was just kind of seeing the shells that people were going to play Nicol Bolas in. I know that people basically played him in the blue-black mid-range deck, splashing red, and then people played him in shells that much more closely resembled like a big red-black deck, or even like leaner mono-red shells.
Or even Jeskai Energy. Or not Jeskai, Grixis Energy.
Right, right. I mean, Grixis Energy, I'm basically gonna call blue
lump
black
in with the blue black decks.
I mean, because I don't think that those decks, like, it's pretty easy. The mana was not the issue there before. It was just really about wanting to play red cards.
Well, it's interesting.
Me,
it is an issue if you decide that you want to play Fatal Push over Magma Spray, right? Because then you're way less likely to be able to play Whirl of Virtuoso and Harness Lightning and things like that. Whereas if you just played a blue-black mana base and then added a little bit of red for Nicol Bolas, like, it would be easy enough to play Fatal Push on one.
Sure, I mean, I would put that down to individual deck-building decisions. Like, I think you could decide whether you wanted to play Grixis or blue-black, but ultimately the decks are going to play pretty similarly.
Yeah, I agree. I'm just saying there are mana considerations when making that decision.
I had a couple of things that I was kind of looking for going into this weekend. Similar to Michael, I want to see Nicol Bolas just passes the theory of words that we've talked about. Like, it just has so many words on it, on a body that's really reasonable, that you kind of just are like, yeah, this will just see play. Like, that's just gonna happen. So I want to see that. And then I also want to see what direction people took with their blue control decks. You know, it seems to me that when it comes down to an event, right? Like, we can talk about MTGO leagues and like what it does on MTGO all the time, but like if we broke down just individual Grand Prix and SEG events for Standard, I think that blue-white outshines the rest of the control decks in Standard by a pretty significant margin. And so I was interested to see, does Grixis control now take the lead with Nicol Bolas and kind of shift that blue-black control deck to play red instead of Teferi? Like, what does it do to the format? So that was one thing that I was interested in. And then the other was, how do green decks play in this new world? Like, and by new world, I just mean we've seen a downtick in, you know, the number of Goblin Chain Whirlers. We see an uptick in Scarab Gods. And what I want to know is, like, what does that mean for Llanowar Elves? What does that mean for Thrashing Brontodon, for all the, for Banefire coming into the format? Like, what changes do these small format changes do for very powerful cards that honestly just haven't been seeing a ton of play? And those were the kind of the three things that I was looking at. So, with that being said, what color would you want to play next week if you were going to play an aggro deck? I think this one's pretty easy, Matt.
Well, I mean, I don't think that the zombies is very aggressive, but I would like to test that at least to find out if that was something I was interested in. But, I mean, obviously I would probably play mono red if I was going to play an aggro deck.
You know, I didn't even think about looking for zombies decks doing well. Did you guys see any zombie decks do well?
I didn't see any personally, but I know that Josh played in the online PTQ, and he said that the zombies decks were quite good against the mono green deck.
Okay.
So that could be an interesting direction to go if the stompy deck does become the powerhouse of the format.
It looks like none of the zombie decks finished at least 6-2.
Sure.
Okay. So, I think that for me, I'm definitely on red. I think the question for me at this point for aggro is there a reason to play black anymore? because like the decks that I have seen, like the decks that I've had the most success with, are just straight up mono red. They're super consistent, and like you just don't need the black anymore. Are you guys having similar experiences?
I'm a lot less incentivized to play the black splash if people aren't going to be playing blue-white control. Like, yeah, I think that was sort of the actual main reason to play it. So.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. You're sort of trying to find the right spot in the metagame, and it's possible that mono-red is in a nice spot again in the next week or two.
Yeah. Okay. What, Matt, you kind of already answered this, but what deck surprised you the most?
What deck did I say last time?
Well, you didn't say a deck. You just mentioned a certain card in the green.
Oh, accent. Yeah, sure. The Thorn Lieutenant. To be honest, I wasn't particularly surprised by the outcome this week. If anything, I was most surprised by the fact that it was so predictable. The first thing Michael and I talked about was Nicol Bolas decks, and then the very next conclusion that we came to was that the Stompy decks would counter them. So it basically played out like we predicted, which is actually pretty rare, I think, for it to play out exactly as you predict.
Yeah. This was definitely a good week to be playing Stompy.
Yeah, I think that Stompy was a surprise for me, only because, like, just in my head, that deck's super bad. I tried playing it a bunch early on in this format, and I've just always hated it. It's always seemed to be, like, the weakest of the good decks, in my opinion. Maybe better than Constrictor a lot of the time, but I was honestly surprised. I also expected more Gift, and in my head, I thought, I don't know why I thought that, because there would be, like, a pretty significant uptick in Abrades if the blue-black deck started playing red. So I don't know why I expected more Gift, other than the fact that it had seen a resurgence at the end of the last format, and I expected that trend to continue. But thinking about it, if you're going to have more, you know, Nicol Bolas's into the format, that just means that there's going to be more Abrades, and that's worse for Gift.
So I have a question for you. If you think that the mono green deck was the poor choice, I mean, even in the last format, what do you make of the MTGO data that they released along with the banned and restricted updates?
I did not look at that.
Oh, well, so
what did it say?
It said that Stompy with Scrounger was the best deck by, it was not necessarily the best deck, but it had the highest win percentage against non-mirror matches by about 7%.
I am shocked by that.
I think we all were, but this
7%,
is,
but I think it was like
it was like 5% above the other top tier decks.
What was the next best?
Black red.
Huh.
Black red was 51. Black red was 50.
You guys are hearing glass break on the podcast right now. I am a little shocked. I think that.
Well, so actually, to be fair, blue white gift was actually the next best. Blue white gift, I think, was 53%. Green black stompy was 57 almost, if I recall correctly, and black red was 52% roughly.
So if we're just getting into last standard, I would have rated decks mono red slash red black number one, probably blue-white control number two, gift decks number three, and then probably blue-black midrange number four.
So blue-black midrange actually performed basically the same as red-black. It was also roughly 52%. I think blue-white might have been sub-50, as well as mono-red was also. Mono-red, I think, was 49.9.
Mono red is 49.9. White blue is 49.5.
We kind of talked about this before the show, but I really hate talking about blue white in the context of Moto, because I think that the best way to play this blue white deck is almost impossible on MTGO.
Sure, that's definitely believable. So that's something to be made of the data given, is that it's somewhat hindered by the ability to use the program.
Not only that, but like, I personally really like the Stompy matchup with control, but a lot of people like the Stompy side of that matchup. So it makes you wonder, like, what percentage of those people are playing on MTGO where they're going to get a lot of free wins against blue-white playing Stompy. Like, that, like the amount of time it takes you to beat the Stompy deck specifically, if they're playing correctly, right? If they are a Scrap Heap Scrounger deck that, you know, plays a couple of Hardy Kurins and, like, plays the game correctly, it's going to be a tough uphill battle for blue-white control on MTGO, where in paper, you can just get a shortcut through so much stuff that you are unlikely to time out. And one of the things that will make you time out playing control is playing against things like Scrap Heap Scrounger, Heart of Kirin every single turn.
Sure. That's definitely fair. They were also posted in descending order of popularity, and what was also interesting about this particular data was that Green-Black Stompy was the least popular of, like, the 25 decks they posted or whatever.
That is also shocking. Yeah. All of these things are so shocking to me.
It was a very interesting post. I was actually really happy with Wizards' decision to post that data, because it completely validated their decision to not ban, and I think that that's a really a good show of faith.
Yeah,
on their
I love
part
it. I'm gonna
well.
Have to. I'm gonna have to go read that, because now I just, like, looked at the bans and, like, jumped off, but now I'll go back and read that. What about you, Michael? What deck surprised you the most?
I don't know. It's hard to say. I was very surprised by any of it when, like Matt said, we basically, this was the guess on more or less exactly how it would work.
Okay.
I think I was a little bit, I don't know why I'm still surprised, but I was impressed that Jeff Cunningham managed to 8-0 the PTQ again with Constrictor.
You guys a master.
Just keeps making that deck work for him. It's kind of shocking. No one else can win at all with that deck, but he is a master.
Well, so speaking of the online data, like, it showed that Constrictor was at, like, what, 51% or 50.5% or something like that? And it makes you wonder how much of that was specifically contributed by Jeff Cunningham, just, like, 5-0-ing 25 leagues
so
or whatever.
Actually, so if we want to be real, the deck that surprised me the most that performed, it looks like, surprisingly well, was the Mono Blue Storm deck. It had a top 8 in the PTQ, as well as a 7-1 and a 6-2. And I know that Josh basically, I was talking to Josh today, and he basically said he only beat it in the top 8 because the opponent just didn't draw lands in...
Yeah, that deck actually seems pretty scary to me. The two decks that surprised me the most were, one, Grixis, quote-unquote, dragons, just being, like, mono-red dragons, and that. Like, So before we get into the dragons deck, Michael, what is the Storm deck, for those who don't know?
The Storm deck, so the main card that it got, it's, like, the paradoxical outcome, well... Doesn't look like it's actually playing... Well, no, okay, so it still is playing Paradox Glaucom. But it's, like... It's an Aetherflux Reservoir deck, and the main card that it got is Psy Master Thopterist. Which seems pretty good in that you don't have to, like, fully go off. You can...
Right, it's kind of like your Epi the Warrens combo.
It gives you kind of a value game to play to. It is a 2-mana 1/4 that is legendary, so it lets you play
mana.
Mox Amber. Yeah, sorry, a 2 and a blue for a 1/4. It's legendary, so it lets you play Mox Ambers that maybe have actual text. And it says, whenever you cast an artifact spell, create a 1/1 Thopter with flying, 1 and a blue, sack 2 artifacts, draw a card. So I assume you're not using the second mode very much, but the first mode is pretty great. And it's especially insane with Paradoxical Outcome, right? Like, you can really Paradoxical Outcome and now draw a huge portion of your deck.
Especially because
of
Mox Amber,
so Paradoxical
right?
Outcome specifically says non-token, so...
Oh, does it say non-token?
Yeah.
Okay. So, although I guess you can't do that, it probably is still making your Inspiring Statuaries better. And it just gives you a secondary win condition.
Yeah, it's just an alternate win condition, so you don't have to Aetherflux Reservoir them every single game.
I think Mox Amber actually tapping for mana is probably
a pretty
big game.
I was going to say, having any card in your deck that makes Mox Amber active is actually probably a big deal. Even though it's, like, not... It's only a 3 of in the deck from the PTQ, it's still not nothing. So, yeah, I agree with Michael on that being a big surprise. The Grixis Dragons deck, though, that's basically, you know... 6 5-mana dragons and two with two demanding dragons, and then as many Nicol Bolas as possible and just Chain Warriors. This kind of looks like a mishmash of this to me. This does not actually scream great deck. Like,
is this similar to the list that Jerry posted last week?
I'm not sure.
It's playing like Chain Whirlers and Sarkins, and
there are a few that did well at the PTQ that are like, it's like Sarkin, Chandra, 4 Glorybringer, 4 Nicol Bolas, 4 Chain Whirler, 4 Scrounger.
Right.
Some Heart of Kieran's just removal spells.
That's basically all of them. They're all Scrypeep, Scrounger, Chain Whirler decks that also play all of them play 4 Glorybringer, and then most of them play 4 Nicol Bolas also. Yeah, all of them play 4 Nicol Bolas.
The one from the Classic cut the Heart of Kieran's for like more demanding dragons, which surprises me. Doesn't sound great, but maybe I'm wrong.
That is interesting.
Yeah, I think those are my biggest surprises. So where do you guys think that the format can head, and like, where do you think it's pretty defined? Like, what's not going to change, and what do you think could change?
Well, I don't necessarily think these decks are going anywhere specifically. I think that they're going to be viable decks for the rest of the season. I think that Grixis Energy is just going to be pretty powerful, or blue black midrange, or whatever you want to call it these days. And I think Stompy has been and is still fine. There still might be a way to attack it from week to week. As far as how I would try to attack this metagame, I'm really sure, to be honest with you. It's really hard to attack both the Stompy deck and the Grixis deck.
Yeah, and all the while having to account for mono red, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, you still have to keep that in your, at least on your radar, and I mean, and blue white control too, for what it's worth. I mean, I don't think that blue white control is in a particularly good position right now. I think that it has an atrocious matchup against the Grixis deck, and I think that it has a slightly unfavorable matchup against the Stompy deck. So I think
can we talk really quickly about that? Because this is something I'm super interested in. So I got into a nice debate with one of our podcast listeners about blue-black versus blue-white specifically. And I have literally lost to that deck one time in maybe 20 matches, probably more than 20 matches. I think that it is one of blue-white control's very, very best matchups.
The blue-black midrange deck?
What do you think about Grixis specifically that swings that in, or do you think that blue black was already that big of a favorite?
Well, I think Glensleeve Siphoner and Champion of Wits are both very good cards against blue white. I don't think that alone makes the matchup insane. I think that their addition of main deck Bloodfast, which I assume that some of the blue black lists were running as well, is also very hard to beat.
Yeah, they started doing that a little bit too.
But yeah, I mean the addition of Nicol Bolas helps a lot. I mean it's something that's going to get value on ETB, which helps, and also it just wins the game when your opponent doesn't have the answer for it anymore.
I agree. It specifically makes like Whirler Virtuoso more of a problem, because Settle the Wreckage becomes worse and worse as your opponent actually has more to do with their lands.
Sure, and it's harder and harder to hold if they're playing, you know, things like Nicol Bolas and, you know, ways to recur it.
Right.
Yeah, the Liliana minus get back Nicol Bolas line specifically seems...
So, I actually think Matt got pretty close to hitting this on the head. So, blue-black midrange was playing 13 creatures, with 3 of them being Scarab Gods at the end, before this core set came out. And these decks are almost all playing 16 or more creatures, with every single one of them outside of Scarab God being very good against control.
Right. Yeah, I certainly don't believe that the Scarab God is good against blue-white.
Right, so with the dramatic increase in the threat density of your deck, I think you swung that matchup single-handedly, because the removal spells you were playing were already always going to be bad against them, but now all of a sudden, just the number of overall cards that is good against them has increased.
Right.
Yeah, I think Whirler Virtuoso specifically is pretty nice in that it makes your Harnessed Lightnings at least do something. In combination with your Glensleeve Siphoners, like those two in tandem are going to give that card some sort of text way more often. And I think that one of the big things in these matchups is not all of your cards have to be great, but all of your it really hurts when you draw cards that are just actual blanks.
Cool. What about you, Michael? Any changes that you could see coming?
It's really hard to say. I don't... If there was something I liked a lot against both Stompy and Grixis, that is what I would be playing, but that's...
Yeah, now that I'm thinking about it a little bit more, I think that it might be worth it to try to go to a Bristling Hydra Hadonis Climb style deck if you believe that you can make the Stompy matchup good, because I remember that being very good against the Grixis decks previously.
Well, one of my concerns specifically in this format right now has been Rhonas. I don't know if you guys have run into this, but like when I was playing this week, the inclusion of Vinemare and a ton of Blossoming Defenses made it really hard to stop a Rhonas from staying active.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. I mean,
the first place go ahead, Michael. Was playing 4 Vinemares in the main, I believe. So
that seems like a ton, right? Like that's a like just like if that's in play, all of a sudden this Rhonas is like this unstoppable thing, and then it like combos with Rhonas also in the fact that like you can target it pretty freely with Rhonas's ability.
Right, you don't get blown out nearly as often in response. It seems really tough.
I think that I honestly, like, as much as I was saying that I pooping on Stompy earlier, I just think Stompy got a lot from this format in Vinemare specifically. Like, I did not look at that card and go like, oh, this is like super powerful, right? But the fact that it can't be blocked by, you know, tokens from Scarab God and like has hexproof, so that it's huge game. Like, it's just huge.
Right. I mean, I would be surprised if, I mean, despite my saying, you know, my surprise to people playing Thorn Lieutenant, I would assume that it's quite good based on the fact that actually everybody was playing it. It was universally agreed upon that Thorn Lieutenant was just better than Resilient Kenra or whatever else you could be playing in that slot.
Well, it kind of plays a similar role to like Sylvan, what was his name?
Sylvan Advocate.
Sylvan Advocate, in that it's like this really like good. Good is a strong word, but like a pretty decent creature on the front side, but like in the late game it scales really well.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I get the appeal of that. My biggest concern is that I generally like to be playing creatures with higher power than mana costs in a deck with Galtas, but they do seem to be moving on the lower end of Galtas now. They're only playing a couple of Galtas, and I think you're mostly siding them out against the Grixis decks anyway, which seem to be your most popular non-mirror match. So I can believe that you're not as priced into playing you know, things like Resilient Kenra to make the 4 power for 2 mana.
Yeah, I would say that the only thing that I could see this format getting that it doesn't have so far is I'm starting to wonder, just from watching this weekend, if Vivian Reed is just main deck playable in a bunch of decks. And if she is as good as she looked all weekend, it's possible that we see more green decks.
Yeah, I can believe that. Although I would say she's at her worst in the green mirrors, so
that's true.
Kind of a
that's
cyclical
true.
Thing.
That's probably a good thing about her too, right? Otherwise it's
right.
Kind of annoying.
Yeah. Yeah, she does not stack up particularly well versus just a bunch of guys.
Right.
Like, if your opponent just has creatures, you're playing a, you know, Fog and Commune with Dinosaurs or whatever stapled together, and that's probably not getting you very far.
Yeah, for significantly more mana.
What do you think was the sweetest thing that saw play this weekend, Matt?
I don't know. Hearing about this mono blue storm deck, that deck sounds very sweet to me. Whether it's good or not is a whole different discussion. But Paradoxical Outcome is, you know, the kind of thing I want to do with my life. So.
So for me, it's always about the green red mid range decks, and seeing those decks do like anything again gives me hope for the world. So having those 5-0 and then put up some results in, I think it had one in the open and one in the, I don't remember. There was two lists they were kind of running around. That makes me happy. I think Glorybringer is like a super underplayed card in Standard right now. And I think it's very good against the green decks like Stompy. So that could be an answer for these type of decks. Although, so, I guess if they're playing this many Blossoming Defenses and Vine Mares, that's not even true anymore.
So someone played 4 of Sarkhan's Unsealing in the PTQ and finished in 9th with it, which is okay. Just super sweet. And then someone else took it and 5-0'd a league with it, adding 4 Traxos to it as an additional 7 drop to trigger your Sarkhan's Unsealings for, you know, the mega mode. And I don't know. If that doesn't make you smile at least a little bit, I don't know what will.
Yeah, I mean, the card is a huge liability against anybody that's not trying to play either. I mean, it's basically a huge liability against non-mid-range decks, right? Like, if your opponent's playing anything akin to an aggro deck, it's going to be awful. And if your opponent's playing a control deck, it's going to be even worse than that. But in the mid-range mirrors, well, this card is king.
It depends, right? It's a cast trigger.
No, I don't think that's true at all, Matt. Because if you... if you get to, like, stabilize the board with, like, some big butt, and then you have time to play a Sarkhan's Unsealing, the game ends when you untap.
Against which deck?
Against aggro decks that you just said it was bad against.
I just don't believe that that's true. Like, playing a 4-mana do-nothing enchantment...
I think this card is definitely bad against aggro. I don't think this card is bad against control decks, though.
Oh, it can go face, can't
it?
Wait,
hold on.
I forgot that it was... I forgot that it can target players. Okay, that's actually not the worst against control decks. It's probably actually good against control decks.
Hold on. This is, like, the type of card that I think is good in both. Like, yeah, it sucks that you're paying 4 mana to do nothing, and you'll board it out, but I don't think it's dead.
It's not dead,
No, I'm not
like,
saying it's dead. You just don't want to draw it in the aggro matchups. Like, if you look at the deck that 5-0'd with Traxos, it specifically has, like, Magma Spray Abrade, Harvester, Deathgorge, Scavenger on the board, and I assume Sarkhan's Unsealing is, you know, one of the cards that comes out when you board.
Oh, dude, I played against this deck like 3 times on Arena. I was like, what is this deck? Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
That seems sweet.
Sweet. All right, well, that Traxos seeing play this weekend is easily the sweetest thing.
Well, that's not really this weekend. That's just in a league deck. But
well, with that being said, guys, what would you play and why, Matt?
I would probably play Stompy. I don't think that people are going to adapt to it quickly enough. I think it's actually pretty hard to target as far as that thing goes. So the biggest problem would be that the arms race of like who can play more Galtas is a real thing.
So. Okay. Michael?
Yeah, I think my inclination is to play Stompy as well, and just getting the numbers correct is maybe a little tricky, but... you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, my inclination is either is Stompy and Grixis. I mean, obviously they're the decks that did the best, but one of the reasons that I really have, like, even on this podcast, changed my tune about Stompy is just, like, the power of Blossoming Defense right now, because of the uptick in Grixis, is pretty big.
Yeah, the biggest thing that I think will stand out if you actually play these games, I know this because... like, when Matt and I were playing decks for Memphis, obviously Stompy wasn't a deck, but Constrictor was a deck, and oftentimes you would end up having to Vraska's Contempt something, where, like, you wouldn't be able to abrade something because it would get out of range or whatever, and if a Vraska's Contempt basically ever gets countered by a Blossoming Defense, the game is always just over on the spot.
Yeah. And that's, we talked about that, I actually had Blossoming Defense in my deck for Denver. I believe it was it Denver that I played Blossoming Defense with my... I think it was Denver. Anyway, I played a tournament with Blossoming Defense on Michael's recommendation with Constrictor a while ago. And it basically, that held true the entire tournament. It was like, if I cast a Blossoming Defense this game, I probably won. Like,
if you're countering Vraska's Contempt, the game's just, it's done.
Yeah, it's pretty much over, and this deck specifically, like, when you think about, like, the threats that you are defensing, like, they're all very similar to the kind of, like, the size of the threats that you might be defensing against.
Yeah,
so
it's like a Galta or a Steel Leaf Champion or something. Like, most of the stuff you're defensing is massive, and your opponent basically has one chance to kill it, and then it runs them over.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, that is it for our week one reactions. So thank you so much, everybody, for listening this week. You can check us out on patreon.com/ccmtg. Become a patron of $1 or more per month. Anything that you donate is really appreciated. You can find me on Twitter at SpencerAgentH. You can find Michael at MagicMikeMTG. You can find Matt at TheWitchClink. And you can find us in the Constructive Criticism family on Facebook. You can email us at ccmtg.info@gmail.com. You can like our Facebook page, check out the rest of the network, and you can join the conversation in that Facebook group or by joining the Discord, which you can find on the bios page, hitting up the clan on MTGO. You can message me at Spencer13Dev or Quinn at Urstripe. It's URTHSTYRPE. And you can tweet at us with hashtag would that be good. Hashtag would that be good. If you tweet it, Michael will read it. Michael, what do we got this week?
That feels like not not how this goes, but the first tweet is from Adam, and he says, when you're helping your wife practice for a 1K, and she says after 5 main deck games, I think you're a good matchup for me.
You have to, the gif is like, it's the Wolf of Wall Street, oh my god, bite my hand gif when he's talking about the very attractive young lady. So, Adam's super into his wife being super into Magic, so good for him.
Is he excited about it or exasperated by it? I can't tell from that gif.
No, he's excited. It's,
okay.
It's because
I could see it either way.
It's what we millennials like to call a turn on, Michael. Millennials. It's his kink, as they would say. It's his kink. What's next, Michael?
Patrick tweets already having epic moments on the stream, and he tags Mason, Spencer, and the trophy mages, and it's me telling Mason to make a play that he doesn't know works, and then he makes it, and then he complains about his opponent doing something on board, which I
knew it was
about,
really funny.
Suggested the play anyways. He felt very betrayed, but I'm not sure why.
It was like a hysterical moment just because of Mason's like reaction, but yeah, it was super fun. So I want to give an anti-shout-out to myself really quick. I was supposed to segue. I need to put it in the show notes. This is why we have show notes. I was going to surprise them by making the training ground sponsored by Oasis and making like another segment sponsored by the Mana Base, but I forgot. So, but you know who won't forget your order is Oasis Games. You can check them out at mtgoasis.com. You can get 5% or 15% off your order depending on using the code CCMDG or hashtag with that be good. Yeah, so did you miss tonight's stream? Don't worry, we got you. Haha. Yeah, and then every single stream will end up on the website, so just check out constructorcriticism.com or the YouTube channel to check out the daily stream. You know, we're missing Mason Clark streaming right now, guys. Like, we gotta hurry up.
But the video's gonna be posted, so
that's true. So we can catch it later. I tweeted tonight on CCMTG. We will discuss the burrito factor mentioned on the spike feed by at Curtis Now. Hashtag would be good. Time to discuss my whiskey versus champagne theory. All right. So this week on the spike feed, they mentioned that when you O2 drop, you need to get something for your time. So you go out and get an awesome burrito to, you know, build up happiness in your life even when you O2 drop. And they said, we don't typically cover this kind of stuff, but I'm sure that we can get Spencer to cover it on Constructor Criticism. So I have a theory. It's the whiskey champagne theory. So this theory starts back when Casey was trying to qualify for the Pro Tour for an online RPTQ, and he tried every deck, and then like the day before the RPTQ, he's like, hey, every deck sucks, teach me how to play Greenhead Ramp. And I was like, okay, come over. And we like played a couple leagues. We might have actually just played one league. He 5-0'd and he's like, okay, we're good. And then I was like, cool, well, let's go get some celebratory champagne for your Pro Tour invite tomorrow. So we went and got champagne, and we drank the whole bottle. We went to bed, woke up, and played the RPDQ, and he won, playing Greenhead Ramp. And then we went and got champagne again. And Devonair asked, like, what would you have gotten in if he lost? And I was like, oh, whiskey. Like, you drink whiskey to be miserable. And so I actually completely disagree with Spike Feed here. I think that when you O2 drop, like, you need to go get something that you hate to punish yourself.
Oh, you have to punish yourself?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'm into. Okay. Yeah. I agree with this
like,
completely.
For me, I'd go to, like, IHOP and order, like, a burger or something just to be like, I deserve this. I'm a terrible human for O2 dropping.
Speaking of things that we...
Michael, what are your
thoughts
on this?
Speaking of things that we hate, how did you guys feel about the IHOP thing?
Oh, it was stupid.
Yeah, and then they just, like, announced that it's just it was just actually IHOP the whole time, and they're like, oh, just kidding.
Yeah, it was one of the worst advertising campaigns. It went from me having a 0% chance to order a burger at IHOP to like a negative 300% chance to order. Actually, it went from me having a 0% chance to order a burger at IHOP to a 0% chance of me entering an IHOP.
Sure.
You literally just said that if you O2 drop, you're going to go to IHOP and get a burger.
I never O2 drop, Michael.
I feel like it put it on your radar as something you could hate eat. And before, it probably just wasn't on your radar at all. So I would say that their advertising campaign was dastardly and successful.
Dastardly, I like that.
Any publicity is good publicity. Seems to be the...
What do you guys think? Do you think that, like, when you do poorly at a tournament, it's time to go eat Korean barbecue? Or do you think it's time to...
No, it's time to, like, hit up a gas station.
And, like, gas station nachos that'll give you, like, food poisoning?
Yeah. That'll right. it, Michael, it'll make right. you have a very negative association with O2 dropping, so you'll try not to do it again.
Hmm. Matt?
I don't know. I think every time is a good time for a Korean barbecue.
Sure. Bad example, because that's true. No, I just think that, like, first of all, I don't want burritos to be associated with me doing poorly in Magic, so I would never, like, go to Chipotle after an O2 drop, because, like, I love Chipotle. I don't want that to be associated with that.
I mean, clearly you haven't lost enough Magic tournaments, because I've lost so many Magic tournaments that if I negatively associated everything that I did afterwards with that Magic tournament, then I just wouldn't do anything.
See, I usually just come home and, like, try and get into an arguing match with my wife so that I think if I lose Magic, I will get into fights with my wife so that I will not want to lose at Magic.
That's great.
That's not true. That is true.
All right. Scotty tweets at Spencer whether you would rather have pineapple on pizza or a pickle flavored popsicle?
It's a pickle popsicle. What?
I don't know, man. I think a pickle popsicle sounds kind
of
good.
No, that sounds awful. That sounds like the worst thing I've ever heard of.
Well, so here's the thing. Don't O2 drop in Sacramento, or you know what I'm going to find and buy for you.
I mean, it doesn't mean I have to eat it. You can buy whatever you want. I tell you what, I'm 0% to eat a pickle popsicle, and slightly higher than that to O2
what
drop.
What about
so.
For dessert after an IHOP burger?
Here's the thing, Scotty, is you asked me what it would cost for me to eat a slice of pineapple pizza on camera. I said it'll be a $1,000 goal on Patreon. When we hit $1,000 a month, I will eat pineapple pizza. That will happen.
I thought you said like, $10,000 or something crazy like that.
What about $1?
Like, I think I said $1,000. No,
if someone gives me $1.
I'm not. Yeah, but I hate pineapple pizza.
That much?
And here's the thing. I don't care at this point if you like pineapple pizza. I know that pineapple on pizza is not something that I enjoy. You do you. I also won't eat your pickled freezer, and you can do whatever you want. I don't care, but I'm not eating this. This isn't happening.
I don't know. I think the pickle popsicle sounds kind of good.
Matt and Michael can confirm that I throw up pretty easily, so like if you try and make me eat this, it's just 100% going to happen. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and we'll see you guys all next week. Magic.